You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Turkey's prime minister announced this week the Turkish army will occupy northern Iraq if the Kurds gain autonomy as part of the Federation of Iraq. Aaron Glantz reports from Diyarbakir near the Turkish-Iraqi border.
An Anatolian rock band blasts out tunes at a children's holiday party in Diyarbakir, the largest Kurdish-majority city in Turkey. The atmosphere is festive. Dozens of 10- and 12-year-olds dance and eat sweets, seemingly without a care in the world. But pull them aside and the children are concerned about the possibility of a chemical attack on Diyarbakir by Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Firat is 13 years old.
So cool.
I don't want to play outside, he says. Maybe a bomb will come to Diyarbakir. I'm worried about dying. The Turkish Kurds are worried enough about a chemical attack that the Red Crescent here has run out of gas masks. The Kurdish people have plenty of reason to fear an attack by Saddam Hussein. In 1989, the Iraqi government rounded up, repatriated, and slaughtered close to 200,000 Kurdish people, gassing 5,000 with a chemical bomb in one day in Halabja. Denise Uzer is a middle school teacher in a village outside Diyarbakir. She wouldn't allow Peace Watch to visit her school for fear of police reprisal. Ozer notes that when Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds, he had the support of the American government. At the time, Donald Rumsfeld was a special envoy for Iraq.
Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons against the Kurdish people. Who sold the chemical weapons? America definitely sold them to Saddam. Why did America like Saddam before, and why don't they like Saddam right now? Kurdish people are curious about that. That's why we think America is using the Kurdish people.
Turkish Kurds are also wary of war because peace has come so recently to Diyarbakir. For more than 20 years, Kurdish separatist PKK guerrillas fought the Turkish military in the cities and countryside of eastern Turkey. Peace came with a ceasefire agreement in 1999. By then, the Turkish military had already killed 30,000 Kurdish civilians. The Kurdish band Elul Tuesday night at Rengen in the heart of Diyarbakir. This is my city, they say. My mother was born here. My father was born here, my grandmother and grandfather were born here, they sing, and I won't leave. Mustafa Akan is president of the Diyarbakir branch of DEHAP, Turkey's largest Kurdish political party. His childhood village was destroyed by the Turkish army in 1994. 40 of his relatives were forced to flee. Akan is worried because 50,000 Turkish soldiers have re-entered eastern Turkey to fight Iraq. Iraqi Kurdish commanders Masoud Barzani and Jalal Talabani have invited the Turkish army into northern Iraq, a move opposed by Turkish Kurdish groups like DEHAP.
Maybe this war can give us some rights in Iraq with Barzani and Talabani and the Iraqi opposition for a federation of Kurdistan or a democratic situation in Iraq. Maybe we can have rights, but everything is going on behind closed doors, so who knows? The USA says all the time, we really want to give liberty for the Kurds, but then America says to Turkey, don't worry, there won't be any Kurdish state. So the messages are mixed and confusing.
Here in eastern Turkey, Mustafa Akan believes only one group of people can stop the war, the American people.
We don't want war. We know that America has experience in war because they went to Vietnam and many young Americans died there. So the Americans know what war is. We want the American people to come together against the war, and we want them to speak loudly to their government. Then we could say it together. We don't want war, and we are against it.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Diyarbakir, eastern Turkey.
Yeah. As we begin a new year, we wanted to provide an historical perspective for our commitment to a diplomatic resolution to conflicts. In the first of a three-part series, author and high school teacher William Rivers Pitt outlines how the ongoing aggression in the Middle East is the continuation of a greater conspiracy for domination of the natural resources of the world by the U.S. and Britain. In his book, War on Iraq, What Team Bush Doesn't Want You to Know, Pitt and former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter dismantle the myths surrounding Iraq's present weapons capability. Despite the fact that during the 7 years of weapons inspections in Iraq, Ritter and other inspectors confirmed that Saddam Hussein's chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons program had been effectively destroyed, the Bush administration continues to push for war. Pitt tells us why.
The history of Iraq did not begin with the Gulf War. Iraq is an industrialized nation of more than 20 million people. It is bordered on the north by Turkey and Syria. Iraq's western border lays against Jordan. To the south is Saudi Arabia, and to the east is Iran. Nestled against Iraq's southeast corner is tiny Kuwait. Iraq is almost completely landlocked. Near the town of Umm Qasr is Iraq's only access to the Persian Gulf. 200 miles to the west of Iraq's border sits Israel, Lebanon, and the Mediterranean Sea. The history of Iraq in the 20th century is dominated by the effects of Western colonialism, American interventionism, dangerous indigenous leadership, the Cold War, and oil. Iraq holds the second largest proven stores of petroleum on the planet, making it a sweet plum for Western industrialized nations. In 1917, British forces invaded Mesopotamia and occupied Iraq, making it a British mandate. Rebellions against the British in Iraq were put down by systematic aerial bombardment. The first time in history such tactics were used. It would not be the last. The borders which define Iraq today, along with the borders of most other Middle Eastern nations, were drawn arbitrarily by the British and the French in the early part of the century. These demarcations knew nothing and cared little for tribal or religious connections that make up the cultural essence of the Middle East. In 1921, the British Colonial Office drew a new line in the sand, carving a border across southern Iraq to create the nation of Kuwait. This was done to deprive Iraq of access to the Persian Gulf. 70 years later, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, he claimed the nation to have always been a part of Iraq. When considering the British penchant for drawing and redrawing maps in the region, there appears to have been merit to his claim, if not to the actions that followed it. In 1932, Iraq was recognized as a sovereign state and joined the League of Nations. The king remained a British creation, however. It was at this point that the chaos that has dominated modern Iraq truly began. In the years immediately after the end of World War II, a newly powerful America began to consider with cold pragmatism where its own self-interest lay. American policy in the Middle East, a policy that has existed to this day, a policy that has played an enormous part in the recent history of the region, can be summed up succinctly in the words of famed U.S. State Department official George Kennan. Kennan, one of the wise men described in the seminal work of that name penned by Walter Isaacson and Evan Thomas, became one of the primary architects of the New World born in the aftermath of World War II. Kennan, in 1948, crystallized American intentions in the Middle East when he said, quote, "The U.S. has about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford the luxury of altruism and world benefaction. We should cease to talk about such vague and unreal objectives as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better." Unquote. This hard-eyed assessment of American priorities came fully into play in 1951, when Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh took power in neighboring Iran and declared that Iran would retain full control of its own oil resources. Within the next 2 years, Mossadegh was deposed and the Shah of Iran installed, due in large part to support provided to the coup leaders by the CIA. Upon his installation, the Shah received assistance from American General Norman Schwarzkopf Sr., father of the famed American general of the Gulf War, in the formation of the fearsome Savak secret police. The Shah became a puppet of American interests, and the people of Iran began a long bout of suffering under his rule. Across the border in Iraq, a man named Saddam Hussein was at the beginning of what became a long, bloody journey through the politics of power. Born in 1937, Hussein joined the Socialist Ba'ath Party in 1956. In 1958, the British-installed king of Iraq was overthrown in a popular revolt by Abd al-Qasim. In 1959, Hussein was one of the assassins involved in an attempted coup against Qasim, who was wounded in the attack. The coup failed, Hussein took a bullet in the leg, and was forced to flee the country to Syria and then Egypt. The years between 1963 and 1968 were chaotic for Iraq. Another CIA-aided coup overthrew Qasim, and the Ba'ath Party briefly took control of the nation. In 1968, Saddam Hussein helped lead another revolt, which made General Ahmed Hassan Bakir leader of Iraq. The Ba'ath Party was in control for good, and Hussein was named vice president. From this position of power, Hussein developed a vast network of secret police designed to root out and destroy dissidents. In 1972, General Bakir nationalized Iraqi oil. President Richard Nixon immediately began to plot the reversal of this declaration, just as America had done when Iran nationalized its oil in 1951. Nixon, along with the Shah, orchestrated the arming of Iraqi Kurds against Bakir. Tell me if that sounds familiar. Iraq was placed on America's lists of nations that sponsors terrorism. In 1975, this course of action was abruptly halted when Vice President Hussein and the Shah reached an agreement that ceded control of the strategically vital Shatab al-Arab waterway in the Persian Gulf back to Iran. In retrospect, it seems clear that Iraq's control of this waterway was the primary concern behind America's agitation against Iraq. Once the American-controlled Shah owned the passage to the Gulf, all American support to the Kurds ceased entirely. In comment upon this, newly resuscitated Henry Kissinger stated, covert operations should not be confused with missionary work. Under Nixon, the arming of Iran by America was dramatically stepped up.
Speaking recently at Boston University, author, schoolteacher William Rivers Pitt, in part one of a three-part series, Making the Case for Peace in Iraq. Tomorrow, part two, thanks to Mark Weaver of community station WMBR in Boston for that segment. A convoy of human rights activists will leave London next month for Baghdad, led by former U.S. Marine Kenneth Nichols. Nichols is a decorated Gulf War veteran, but he's now an outspoken critic of the Bush administration's policies to launch another war against Iraq. Dennis Bernstein, host of KPFA's Flashpoints program, recently spoke to Nichols from his home in the Netherlands.
A lot of people join the military for reasons that are quite different from the reasons for joining in other countries. For myself, it was money for college. It was also a means to see the world, although not in the way I intended. And I personally felt like I was lacking in initiative and discipline, and I thought that the Marines would instill that in me. So I would always maintain that that was the stupidest decision of my life. Yet at the same rate, I think there's so much good that has come out of it, and I've learned so many tremendous lessons from the experience that I don't regret it. But I can't deny that I was quite an idiot for doing it in the first place. I'm not proud of serving in the war, or any war for that matter. And of course, I've grown a little bit since then. I've evolved, I think, in a good way. And I see this war for what it is. And I feel a very deep need to go to Iraq. I think that we as people have the opportunity to stand up and prevent wars. Democracy has failed us. Voting is not working. Recycling is not enough. If we're not willing to put our lives on the line, potentially, at least some of us, and stand up and act directly, then this world is going to get worse, and our children are really going to pay dearly.
Well, in 1991, you were serving in the 2nd Battalion of the Marine Corps. You were an infantryman on the road to Basra. Tell us a little bit about your military experience.
Well, we sat on the border of Kuwait in Saudi Arabia during the air war, and then when the ground war kicked off, our job was to get to the main road that you've just noted and secure that road as quickly as possible. And it took us about a couple of days, and we went through pretty much unopposed. We did have one skirmish where shots were fired in our direction. Now, for all I know, that could have been our own troops firing our way. I don't know. It was at night, but I did hear a couple of bullets fly by, and I personally did not fire my weapon, so I know I did not kill anyone personally, but, you know, that was what rated us a combat action ribbon. I certainly don't liken that to the experience of Vietnam vets and whatnot. I mean, it's completely different. But at the same rate, you know, we had a reasonable fear for our lives. But the bottom line was the Iraqi soldiers, poor people, I mean, they had no desire to be there. They had been beaten down so badly by that air war. They had no desire to fight, and they just ran as fast as they could. And as you know well, the highway to hell was another tragic massacre that the American military committed against these retreating people who really had no will to fight. And my job was basically in a support role to secure that road.
What happened to the Iraqi troops?
Well, they were fired on while they were in full retreat by the U.S. military from the air and from the ground, and I don't know exactly what the numbers were, but there was a sizable amount of Iraqis that were basically murdered. I mean, they obviously were not fighting. They were retreating full speed and just being blown away as if it were target practice.
Now, let me ask you something about your own background. You joined the military, you said, in part to get the money for an education. Do you come from a military family, or did you have a sense of patriotism?
That really wasn't the motivation. I can say, as in my youth, I certainly didn't have any shame in America. I was raised to love America, and I developed my opinions in life based on my experiences and my knowledge. And when I was younger, I think I fell right into that trap, as most kids do, into the indoctrination process. And I pretty much thought America was a good country and stood for good values. You know, when I joined the military, it really wasn't to be a patriot. It was, as I said, I felt I was lacking in initiative and discipline, and I thought that that would help instill it in me.
You've come a long way. You're talking to us from Holland. You're about to lead this convoy of human shields to Iraq. You've also denounced your U.S. citizenship. Why have you done that?
It really is funny to me. It's very strange. I mean, citizenship is something that we don't think about. We're just born with, and I guess we don't question. I think a lot of Americans think, yeah, they're very proud to be American, and that's the extent of what they think about citizenship. But the reality is that citizenship is allegiance. It's not just some abstract reality. It's a very, very specific, definable reality. And as a citizen, you have an allegiance. You have rights and you have obligations. Some of those obligations are to pay taxes and to also fight in wars if called up, and so on and so forth. For me, it was quite obvious that I know enough about U.S. foreign policy, and I know you know enough about U.S. foreign policy. I mean, I don't think there can be any doubt, if we look at the objective facts, whether the United States is in fact really the greatest terrorist of the 20th and now the 21st century. We look at the bombing campaigns, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the policies in Central and South America, support for apartheid, support for Suharto. I mean, you name it. Every single bloody atrocity that's happened practically over the last century has been done with U.S. support or some sort of involvement, usually direct involvement. Looking at that, the treatment of Native Americans, treatment of black people in America, and treatment of the Hawaiian people, where I lived for the last 6 years of my life, I was so ashamed and disgusted with it. It was just logical that I would say, you know what, I don't want any part of this. I'm not in agreement with this, and the government that's in place does not represent me. I don't vote because I know I don't have any real choice anyway. And if I vote for the Green Party or whatever, I know my vote isn't going to count for anything at this point, unfortunately. So the bottom line is, I'm not being represented. I do not agree with these policies. I refuse to fund the murder of other people and then sit here and talk about peace. And for myself to be at ease and at peace with myself, it was a necessary step. So I renounced my citizenship.
Now, you've said, I quote, "I'm going to Iraq. I understand that I will likely not survive a U.S. invasion." So you are very serious about putting yourself in harm's way when the bombs start to fall.
Yeah, no, I definitely intend to be out and about. And, you know, I want to film the worst of it all. And I don't think there's any way to do that. And I know you can speak from experience that that's a potentially very dangerous thing. Aside from that, I mean, once the bombs start dropping, you know, that's going to be risky enough. But when the American forces and their allies come in there, I mean, you know, it's just the easiest thing in the world to get rid of those troublemakers that might be being a bit of a nuisance. And the American troops this time around are going to be my mortal enemy. And I've made it quite clear anyway, based on the absolutely ridiculous reality of American law at this point, the president has the ability to murder anyone. They've said it's constitutional and it's legal. Post-9/11 legislation allows it. And if somebody is identified as having any kind of linkage to so-called terrorists, then the president can murder them outright. And they have done so in Yemen just the last month. In my case, I consider myself an enemy combatant, not because I'm a terrorist, not because I'm going to be involved in any kind of violent action, but because we live in a world where the people who have power nearly only need to say that you're a terrorist or associated with terrorists, and they can kill you. I understand that reality, and, you know, if I was them, if I was sadistic and murderous as they were, I'd kill me. I mean, why not? Let's get rid of this guy. This is the best chance we're going to get, probably.
You say you're bringing a camera?
Oh, yes, definitely.
You're going to be filming this?
Unfortunately, I don't have the greatest camera, so if things are happening at night, it's going to be quite difficult to film things. But yes, I will film anything and everything. I mean, if there's body parts lying around, then I'll film that. If there's bombs dropping, I'm going to film that. If a hospital gets hit, I'm going to film that. I mean, whatever, you know, whatever the real damage is, I'm certainly going to be there and do the best I can to make sure that the people know.
Now, will this be a militant civil disobedience? Will you be carrying a weapon or just a camera?
No, but the reason why I won't carry the weapon is not because I don't believe in self-defense. I do believe in self-defense, and I've said this on record many times, and I know I don't get the support of many more people because I say this, but the reality is if I was born in Palestine, for instance, and I had to experience 24-hour curfews and look at my family members being killed, my homes being bulldozed, I can't say that I would have ended up a peaceful person. In fact, I think I probably would have been one of those suicide bombers had I been put in that kind of environment. I mean, that's going to make you nuts. And if you're a passionate individual who refuses to accept an unjust and oppressive environment where people are being murdered that you love, you're probably going to get pretty pissed off and you might act out in a violent way. And I don't blame people for doing that. I understand why they do this. I personally won't carry a weapon because I was raised in a different way. I have the ability, I think, to impact the world in a positive way without reverting to violence. But I myself cannot and will not condemn somebody for fighting for themselves. But I think if I were to carry a weapon in Iraq, I mean, come on, what am I going to do, beat the U.S. military? I mean, it just gives them the perfect excuse to blow me away. If I was backed into a corner and had the means to defend myself, and if it were my life or someone else's, I would defend myself. At the end of the day, I want peace. I believe in peace, and I believe Gandhi's principles of peace are the most valuable lessons that we could learn from and that we should employ nonviolent strategies whenever and wherever possible. But I must say, I see it as the biggest of hypocrisies for Americans who are paying into a U.S. tax system that is $369 billion a year for military to talk about peace and then condemn people who live in Palestine or any other part of the world who fight back violently. I see that as sheer hypocrisy, and I think it behooves all Americans to seriously look at refusing to pay taxes.
We are speaking with Kenneth Nichols O'Keefe. He is a former U.S. veteran, medal winner, was in the first Gulf War, and he is now ready to give his life to present himself as a human shield to protect Iraqis when, and I don't say if, when the United States starts bombing. You have any doubt that there's going to be a war here?
Oh, you've got that right. I mean, you know, this has been predetermined. You know, it's really tragic when the only people really telling the truth in world government is the Iraqi government or others that are under threat of the U.S. I mean, they know what this whole U.N. Inspection thing is about. It's a farce, and it's a pretext for war. The United States has their best attorneys making sure that these resolutions are worded in a way that ensures a material breach, and come the January 27th statement by the U.N., the U.S. will have their material breach, and then the war will be started, and the farce will only be perpetuated. So I do not think there's anything that could stop this war except for one thing, a mass migration of people down to Baghdad right now. Americans, Europeans, people of the world, get to Baghdad right now and say, you know what, George Bush is saying the world has spoken and that we need to disarm Saddam. No, the world is speaking and the world is saying the United States needs to disarm and stand back and stop your oppressive, murderous policies. You are, the United States, the biggest threat to the safety and security of this planet. You're violating people all over the world. And only a fool who is just shrouded in denial could not realize this. Yes, I don't think that we're so powerless that we can't stop this war, but it'll take a small miracle, and people will need to realize that if we do act in mass, if we do migrate down there by the thousands, we could stop this war.
Former U.S. Marine Kenneth Nichols speaking with Dennis Bernstein, host of Pacifica's KPFA's Flashpoints. Finally tonight, on a lighter note, in case you're a bit late getting your Christmas gifts this year, Peace Watch has a few gift ideas of our own.
Davis Radio Theater Flyby.
And war is not my first choice. Don't get, you know, it's my last choice, but nevertheless, it is an option in order to make the world a more peaceful place.
You may have heard of the George W. Bush talking doll, and you may know that dolls of favorite past presidents are in development. But what about cabinet-level staff? This Christmas, share the joy of policy and diplomacy with the White House Brain Trust Collection. Teach your children to skip secondhand sources like the president. Hear executive opinion from the source. Vice President Dick Cheney, is soft, cuddly, and squishy. Filled with undisclosed petroleum products, Dick is oozing with joy.
Just how soon, we cannot really judge. Intelligence is at best an uncertain business, even under the best circumstances.
Dick Cheney is major league fun, big time.
The freedom-loving peoples of the region will have a chance to promote the values that can bring lasting peace.
But step aside, Dick. Here comes National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Not to be outdone by old rich white men, Condi is smart, sophisticated, and she knows it. Don't backtalk her, just listen.
We have to keep, in a sense, a gun pointed to the head of the Iraqi regime because that's the only way that they cooperate.
When Condi Rice speaks, she's someone to look up to.
We very often underestimate the degree to which people, if they're given a choice between tyranny and freedom, will choose freedom.
Finally, what better way to complete your collection than with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld? In charge of our armed forces, Don is full of mirth and good humor that anyone can appreciate.
Are you talking about every single human being in the Army is going to behave himself or herself? Not likely.
Donald Rumsfeld, funny like your uncle, but unstable like your grandfather.
And of course, the advantage of not acting against the moon would be that no one could say that you acted. They would say, isn't that good? You didn't do anything against the moon. The other side of the coin of not acting against the moon, in the event that the moon posed a serious threat, would be that you then suffered a serious loss, and you're sorry after that's over.
The White House Brain Trust Collection. You can bend them, pose them, and fully manipulate them. Sound redundant? So do they. Get all three and have an interactive policy discussion, each sharing a unique point of view.
Regime change for Iraq.
A regime that could respect its neighbors.
Regime change in Iraq would bring about a number of benefits to the entire region. It has not been that for some other countries, and I guess life's just untidy.
They're the movers and shakers that everyone's talking about. The White House Brain Trust Collection, a guaranteed Christmas delight.
The White House Brain Trust Doll Collection, brought to you by the Davis Radio Theater. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias, and our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.